Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. We visit the makeshift migrant camp in Dublin city centre where concerns are growing over the health of hundreds forced to sleep rough amid disease and a lack of sanitation.
I only saw these things on TVs. I never thought maybe one day this thing will be happening to me. I never expected it. As it is, I'm still trying to come to terms.
Also on the programme, all Irish bands pull out of the South by Southwest Festival in Texas over its links with the US Army in protest over the war in Gaza. We speak to Faye O'Rourke, singer-songwriter with Soda Blonde. And another case of measles has been confirmed today, the fourth so far this year, as an urgent public health alert remains in place. There are growing concerns over the deteriorating health of asylum seekers who've been forced to sleep rough in a makeshift migrant camp in Dublin. Around 270 people are now sleeping in long rows of tents next to the International Protection Office on Mount Street amid disease and a lack of basic sanitation. Ciara Doherty visited the camp earlier today and filed this report.
Well, it's just after 4 o'clock on this rather wet, bleak Wednesday afternoon in Dublin city centre. I'm outside the International Protection Office, where for the last hour we've seen this sort of constant stream of people queuing up, waiting to go into the office for what we presume is their appointment to have their applications for asylum processed. Now, some of them do leave with their suitcases and get into taxis and head off to what we assume is some form of accommodation. But for many others, they are being told that there is no accommodation available. And so they come out here and they hope to get a tent and to join one of the other tents that have sprung up right around this International Protection Office. You'll see just a row of them here, but it goes right up the other street there. There must be close to 100 of them. In terms of amenities, I can't see anything on site. I've seen a number of individuals urinating on the street, and there is a huge amount of rubbish beginning to gather. Roisin, could you describe what we are looking at all around us here?
Well, we're at the International Protection Office on Mount Street in Dublin, in the city centre, less than a mile from Leinster House. And we have a tent city, some people are calling it, where there are about 120 tents of homeless asylum seekers, actually round the sides, wrapped around the whole building, right in behind. And around the side, there are a few Irish homeless people as well. But the reason why they're here is because this is the first port of call, the first point of contact you would come to for protection. And you're supposed to get protection on arrival. You know, there are reception laws or rules, but people were being put out without a tent or a sleeping bag.
So you said there's about 100 tents and there could be two, maybe three individuals in those tents. So there's a couple of hundred people here, and predominantly from what I've seen today, it is young males.
Yeah, it's all males. We call them our brothers. They're all black and brown males, and they're of a similar age bracket as well. And some people have been here, like this one man here, for 82 days. You know, when I meet him every day, we greet each other by him expressing how long he's been here. Like last week, 76, Roisin. Today it's 82.
What facilities are available to these men?
They can't go. There's no dignity. There is no bathroom. There's no toilet. There's a makeshift bucket over there. The smell as we're standing here is just unbearable. Like, it's overwhelming. It's disgusting. And the pee and the feces, that's all over there in the corner. And then when people walk by there, they're picking it up on the soles of their shoes. And then you're getting into your tent. And I mean, I have to disinfect my shoes before I even get into the car. And people are sick. I don't understand why toilets couldn't have been brought here. I don't understand why doctors and nurses couldn't come here.
There was a doctor who came here on Friday night in a voluntary capacity. What did she find?
So she was here on Friday night. I met her, it was freezing. She came without hesitation and she stood inside the corner over there. There was no curtain to shield people. You know, she did her best. She spoke as privately as she could and she found people to be... I think someone was sent in an ambulance or went to hospital and they're awaiting an MRI. You know, she found different levels of sicknesses. I didn't even ask her, but I know afterwards she wrote a report about the scabies. That's how I know about that. And I suppose she had to tell us about that because it's contagious. And for everybody's safety, you know, she just told us that we needed to mask up and glove up and be extra careful. And then, I heard her the other night say that there were respiratory illnesses as well.
And do you have a tent for tonight?
No, I don't. Not yet. I don't even know where I'm going to get it from.
So as it stands, you have no plan?
No plan for tonight. Only God knows where am I going to get the shack for tonight, where I can sleep. Truly speaking, I never expected this. I only saw these things on TVs. I never thought maybe one day this thing will be happening to me. I never expected it. As it is, I'm still trying to come to terms with, am I going to survive here or not? But going back is not an option. I only found out today that there is a problem with accommodation. Everything is in God's hands. I don't know what's going to be. I don't know what tomorrow brings for us. It's only God knows.
Ciara Doherty speaking to one of the new arrivals to the camp at the end of that report. Well, joining me to discuss this are Green Party councillor Donna Cooney, Labour Party TD and Justice spokesperson Eoin O'Riordan, Paul Hosford, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and by Emma Lane-Spollin, National Coordinator of the Ukraine Civil Society Response. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme tonight. Donna Cooney, I want to come to you first because from a council point of view, what's your reaction to seeing dozens of tents home to over 200 people? 270 people is the latest estimation of the number who are now living in this encampment, in this tented city, as it's been described in that report, in the heart of our capital. What's the council response to that?
It's very upsetting, and I, among with other councillors, spoke about it today at our housing meeting. Dublin City Council have gone down and cleaned up and taken away the rubbish and have committed to doing that and keeping it clean. They can do that within the remit. They can keep the streets clean. I did request if they could put in toilet facilities because I believe that the men have places they can go during the day, but there's nowhere in the evening for them, you know, for those conveniences. I was informed it wasn't really something that was maybe suitable for that area, but I think when there's an emergency situation like this, you just have to really do whatever you can to...
And what was the reasoning behind suitability? Because people would also say 200 tents are not suitable for that area.
Yeah.
Or 200 people over 100 tents. And those tent numbers, as we could see, growing by the day.
Yeah. Well, I think it's Dublin City Council. Homeless services are not responsible for the housing because it's actually under international protection in terms of housing the people that are homeless. Normally, with the homeless services, they deal with, you know, people that are under the homeless services. Mm-hmm. So that is where, you know, they're saying they're not responsible, but at the same time, we're saying under a human crisis situation that they need to take those measures and they need to look, because it's, I mean, I believe 90 men were given accommodation. So as you say, they see people going off, but more are arriving day on day off. We had more people arriving in January and February than 53% more than we had last year. So, I mean, we're just going to have to deal with this in terms of the accommodation has to be, a solution needs to be found.
I just want to get clarity on who is responsible, say, for toilet facilities and waste management. Is that council responsibility?
Well, the council are responsible for waste management. They must keep the streets clean, whatever it is, that they're responsible for the cleanliness of the street. So they have taken on that responsibility.
We've seen the rubbish mounting up.
Yeah. Well, they have only just taken that responsibility, and the same that they have now agreed to clean it up. And if it takes, you know, a couple of times a day to pick it up. They did go out with a flat pack truck today and they picked up all that.
But they didn't up until now.
They didn't. Well, not that I'm aware of, that they didn't up till now. I think it was quite clean up to a certain point. There wasn't all that litter. I've been down there a couple of times and it was actually kept quite clean up to the issue with the snow. And then there was the snow and a lot of tents were, you know, and a lot of items were destroyed and they were put to the side. So if you go up to the point of before that, the men were keeping it very clean, actually. It's really deteriorated
but
in
no
the last couple of weeks. Yeah, but they were keeping it very clean. Prior to that, we're now in Ramadan as well, so people are not actually eating or drinking until sun goes down. So obviously, if you're eating and drinking at that time, you know, they were waiting and going to the conveniences first thing in the morning. There's nowhere open at night for them to use the toilets. So, you know, these things, it's a worsening situation in terms of their health and their well-being, and something needs to be done about it. Some emergency measures need to be put in place, be them temporary, but it cannot be let like this, yeah. You know.
Eoin, you've been down there yourself. You posted a social media video from the encampment earlier today saying it's an insult to everything that Irish people hold dear and it's happening on the government's watch. Do you think the government allowed this to happen?
Yeah, I do. It's a direct result of government policy not to house international protection applicants who are male. They've made this decision and this is the result of it. And it's going to get worse because of the change in the Ukrainian regulations. 90 days, after 90 days of being here for new applicants from Ukraine, they're going to be, in that position as well. We're not just talking about 200 or 270 individuals in that location. It's 1,200 in the country who don't have accommodation. It's a direct result of government policy. We don't need a portal out down there. We need them not to be there, not to be living in tents. It's disgusting. Mm. They're getting scabies. There's doctors who are reporting a rise in cases of TB. They are coming from, many of them, places of absolute trauma, including Palestine. And they come here, and this is what we provide for them. And by the way, this week, you'll have the Taoiseach in Washington trying to tell the American administration how we should have a bit more of a sympathetic view of the undocumented Irish in America. It's hypocritical and it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're down there, the lack of dignity, the lack of respect, the sense of despair, when talking to them, to the individual that I did speak to, I only spoke to a few, they wanted to talk about playing football. They wanted just to be young men. They just wanted to engage in society. They didn't want to complain. So I was insulted by what I saw, yeah. and I was ashamed that this is happening in our city. But we have to place the blame where it belongs. It's a direct result of government policy. And it is going to get worse.
We did get a Department of Integration statement saying, despite the exhaustive efforts of the department, they say the supply of available accommodation for international protection applicants has very seriously diminished. And at the same time, the highest ever monthly arrivals of people seeking protection occurred in January and in February of this year. That's approximately, they say, 1,800 and 1,600, respectively, for January and then into February. Emmeline Spollen, when you see the images, when you see that that video from today, What's your reaction? Do you see this as a humanitarian failure by the state?
You've taken the words out of my mouth. It's a humanitarian crisis, mm-hmm. and it's just appalling. We know, like, when people are at their lowest, that's when we should be helping them, right? And these are people who are seeking asylum from places like Syria, from Palestine. We know that they need sanctuary and we're leaving them on the streets. And I agree, it is government policy. We also know that there are 4,000 beds vacant being paid for yep. in the system. Mm-hmm. They should be being used, right? We know that when the snow came and the media had an uproar, we were able to get men off the streets from the snow for 2 days and then we put them back out. And it has been raining for the last 3 days. And this is just it. What is the problem is because we know that there is capacity here and we know we're putting people's lives in danger. And for me, I think it is a disgrace and it doesn't really fit with Irish values.
Let's just have a little listen to what the Taoiseach had to say around this. He was asked in Boston, where he is right now, about the situation of more than 200 people seeking asylum and being forced to live in tents right now. And here's what he had to say about that.
Well, look, I've no difficulty in doing so. I don't think it'll change the situation, though. The situation is that we've had a very big increase in the number of people entering Ireland irregularly. It's more than quadrupled since 2019, and that's creating a very challenging situation. And, you know, I would say to people who are thinking of coming to Ireland irregularly that if they are coming from a safe country where they have accommodation, we can't guarantee you accommodation in Ireland, and that's very clear. And indeed, out here in America, where they're facing exactly the same problems, so many people on the move in the world.
Is that the message, Paul, from government? You know, you see people in tents. Please don't come here.
Yeah, but it's been the message for the last few months that we won't be housing single male asylum seekers, or that, you know, if the accommodation isn't there, you won't receive state accommodation. That message has gone out months ago, but we still see record numbers coming in January and February. The changes to the arrangements for Ukrainian benefits of temporary protection, they kick in tomorrow, but they were flagged months in advance, so we still saw a large number of people. It didn't seem to work. I think that the thing about this is that there's a real question of dignity and of humanitarian compassion. We can talk about the reasons. We can talk about whether or not these men should be here, or they're coming from safe countries, or passports, or any of the things that people will talk about online. But standing there today or looking out, walking past Mount Street and questioning anything beyond how do we help these people is like standing beside a well that people have fallen into and arguing about whether or not they should have been there in the first place.
It is worth noting as well that Mount Street is a 5-minute walk from the Dáil. Like, we're talking about a very short distance away.
So 5 minutes to walk there. There are also,
is
by
there
the way,
unease within government about that?
Well, I don't know. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know
unease.
If there's a...
I believe that there is unease. I mean, I don't think it's about apportioning blame. Actually, it's about not only government taking responsibility, but it's about everybody taking responsibility in the sense that people are objecting to housing people that are coming over under international protection, particularly, single men. And that needs to stop. And then there are certain people that are providing accommodation, but putting, a brevet on that it needs to be families, or it must be, you know, people from a particular.
But so even if you get to a point.
So we cannot rely on private, accommodation.
So
we
you're need to be looking blame, at the state. Blame the protesters, blame the people
no,
that's blocking
that there's,
accommodation
there's a whole,
here
I'm
as well.
I'm saying that I'm taking on blame because everybody feels we're all taking on responsibility, but I'm saying that we shouldn't proportion it. Yeah, well, we shouldn't proportionate blame. We all want to try and do the best for these. Once you know these people and you know they're humans like everybody else,
but
you know, some people are leaving Nigeria.
How has it got to this point? Eoin, you wanted to come in there.
It's a direct result of government policy. We just saw the Taoiseach saying he could walk down there and it wouldn't change a damn thing. Mm-hmm. That's what he's just said. It won't change a thing. And we also know that a year ago, there were tents set on fire in that very location. They are wide open to being attacked. And they've already had individuals coming down with sticks and hitting the top of the tents. All right? They've already had that. So we're all going to we're all going to be first and very vocal in our condemnation if there's an assault or an attack in that location. But we've had 23 arson attacks in the last number of years. Where is the sense from government that this is a humanitarian
and
issue?
And where are people to go? Those arson attacks are also taking place in accommodation that's earmarked for asylum seekers.
What I'm saying is that I feel that there is a sense within government, not necessarily the political system, but certainly within the permanent government, as in the civil service and the various different department officials, who are quite happy with these images because this is the type of, push factor that they want to put out to the world. And it's not good enough.
We have our obligations under international law.
But we're breaking them. We're breaking UN law.
Yeah, well, I agree we need to solve this. You know, I'm totally in agreement with you on this, you know.
All right. Emma, just to bring you in on that, do you think that there is within government and within, permanent government, as Aylm's referring to there, talking about the civil service, a desire, to get the numbers down, to get the number of Ukrainians coming over here down, as well as international protection applicants, because we have new measures being brought in tomorrow to cut the entitlements to Ukrainian people and also new rules around accommodation that will be offered to them. I mean, how concerning is this 90-day centre option for people when we're in an accommodation crisis?
Yeah, so I suppose two things. Yes, emphatically, I believe this is a policy of deterrence. The government does not, and the permanent government would like people to stop coming. They're exhausted, and I fully accept that, and I understand we're working in a really hard context, but we're also working in a global context of enormous, war in Ukraine, Gaza. All around us, there is huge movements of people and very few are coming to Ireland and less coming to Ireland than the rest of Europe. And we had less refugees and international protection applicants in Ireland in 2023 than the year before. So the new things, it is about deterrence and it is really worrying because it's not
practical.
What
we hear from government around this is that they are keeping, up with their, the European legislation in this area. And in other areas, we're just in keeping with other countries on this. So what do you say to that?
We have an accommodation issue. No, not even that. It's disingenuous, right? And even the Oireachtas Library research report, which the government is relying on, has health warnings from every single paragraph saying this is not comparable data, right?
But you heard the minister actually said we need to provide this amount of accommodation every year on a year on because it's not going to finish. There is strife and war throughout the world. Mm. We are going to have people coming in for international protected refugees.
These centres that will, offer people respite and a roof over their heads for 90 days and then after that go forth and find somewhere to live?
On 38 quid a week.
Well, it's not going to work.
We're not going to have accommodation for people straight away. We're building as quickly as we can.
So where
some
are
of the
they
people that are coming
go?
Over
I mean,
will start working
that,
after 6 months and build as well. The plan after the 90 days, people will be able to get any rights. They can go on and get onto the housing list. They can get the social welfare payment. They can work and whatever accommodation we will actually have to apply.
That's actually not true. They can't go on the social housing list. They cannot access HAP. So absolutely, they cannot. So the whole 90 days is it's a farce because nobody is going to be able to arrive in a country with limited English, trauma, find their feet based out in Stradbally, get a job and be able to afford rent. The average rent of one bedroom apartment in Ireland now nationally is 1,500. There are less than 500 properties available nationally for 1,500. So there is no way that a woman with two children is going to be able to afford that.
There's going to have to be accommodation.
But we're not.
Because we cannot have families on the living on the street.
I agree with you, but they're not. That is not the plan.
We'll have to leave that conversation there for now. My thanks to Donna Cooney and to Emma Lane Spollen. The others are staying on with me. After the break, we speak to Faye O'Rourke from the band Soda Blonde about why they boycotted South by Southwest. Do stay with us.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome back. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees says at least one staff member was killed and 22 others injured after an Israeli strike on one of its food distribution centres in war-hit Gaza. It comes as a ship carrying 200 tonnes of relief supplies is due to arrive near Gaza tomorrow. Well, earlier I spoke to former UNRWA spokesperson Chris Guinness. I began by asking him about this latest attack.
Well, 60 people were working in this food distribution centre. And to be clear, this is life-saving work because mass starvation is breaking out. It's reported that a 15-year-old boy was among those killed. And that's why I say that there needs to be an investigation for war crime, because the Israeli army has an obligation to make sure that its attacks are proportionate and that they distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. And it's very clear already, because it was an attack where 60 people were working, that there are questions to be asked. And I would also say that the information from this investigation needs to go to the ICJ, which is investigating Israel for genocide, and also to the International Criminal Court, which is also investigating, and where there can be an investigation to establish personal criminal liability, all the way up to the top, to Prime Minister Netanyahu and to the Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant.
And we know now that there are other methods being used in order to get aid through because of that delay in aid coming through the Israeli borders. A ship carrying aid will reach the Gaza shoreline tomorrow. It's carrying 200 tonnes of water, food and vital medicine. Will this make all the difference? Put it in perspective for us about what's happening on the ground and how badly it's needed.
To be clear, this is a pilot. And if it succeeds, it would be a serious feather in the cap of the senior UN coordinator for humanitarian aid and reconstruction, Sigrid Kaag, because she has a plan. She's been mandated by the Security Council Resolution 2720 to massively ramp up humanitarian assistance. So there's another huge hundreds of tons of aid in Larnaca, the port of Larnaca in Cyprus, waiting to come through into northern Gaza, where food kitchens have been established by two organizations using hundreds of local volunteers. Concurrent with that effort to bring in the food to the north, the Americans are building a huge pontoon port, which it is hoped will be ready within the next 2 months. There may be an interim, a temporary port also established within a matter of weeks. And at that point, phase three of this plan can kick in, and that would see a massive ramping up of food aid, medicine, water, other supplies coming in to Gaza. And here UNRWA, I think, will play a really important role. Only UNRWA, with its 13,000 staff, its warehouses, its food distribution centres, will be able to distribute aid at scale, which is what is needed now that the UN is warning that 576,000 people are now slipping into starvation.
But we have heard how UNRWA's operations are under threat at the moment, given the current shortfall in funding, triggered by as yet unsubstantiated claims or evidence that UNRWA workers were involved in the October 7th attacks. That triggered a whole stalling of funding from countries around the world. So what's happening, your operations, and will they be able to keep going at this really important time?
Claire, there is no choice. In or near UNRWA's 154 facilities, its installations, are 1.9 million displaced people. So stopping is simply not an option for UNRWA. And actually, if you look at the latest update from UNRWA, food was distributed to nearly 400,000 people in the south and in the central areas. Seven of UNRWA's 23 primary health clinics are actually functioning. That's what's happening on the ground against all odds, and over 160 UNRWA staff have been killed, by the way. And I would say in addition that I think the Secretary General should make a trip and come and show solidarity and support for UNRWA, because its services are absolutely vital at this time. So let's see some solidarity from the top of the United Nations. UNRWA is determined to carry on, but there's a political attack on the organisation. There's a financial attack on the organisation, though, because this dodgy dossier, which the Israelis put round, has been shown to be exactly that, baseless and dodgy. The European Union has come back The Swedish government has come back. The Canadians have come back. God bless Ireland, who never deserted UNRWA. But the funds are coming back to some extent. But then on the ground, we're seeing these attacks. There has to be a ceasefire. The Secretary General has said that the humanitarian system is broken. Against that background, UNRWA is determined to continue. But what we're seeing is mass starvation, which is being televised on our TV sets every night. This is unprecedented in human history. For a deliberate starvation, a deliberate famine, which is taking place as a result of political choice, it's a starvation of choice. And as I keep saying, starvation is a slow motion massacre. This is a slow motion massacre of choice, and the madness simply has to end.
Chris Gunness speaking to me a short time ago. I'm joined now by Faye O'Rourke, singer-songwriter with Irish band Soda Blonde, one of the 10 bands who have withdrawn from the US festival South by Southwest over its links to the American military. I'm also joined again by Eoin Ardoin and Paul Hosford. You're very welcome along to the programme, Faye. You are supposed to be in Texas right now.
Yes, and I'm not. And
so
I can
tell us about that decision and why you made the call to boycott such a major music festival for up-and-coming bands.
I think for us, we were so excited initially at the prospect of going over and being included in this. It is kind of the mecca of festivals for up-and-coming bands. But just over the weekend, upon, you know, discovering the links to the US Army, it's a super sponsor of this festival. And not only that, but there's, you know, military defense contractors actually exhibiting, you know, military technologies, and that's just, no band should have to endorse, you know, the machinery of war and you know, sing their songs while you know, there's a humanitarian crisis in Palestine. It's absolutely abhorrent. I can't understand.
Were you aware of these links and this sponsorship of the festival at the time when you signed up?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's the first year, I believe, that this affiliation is there. And yeah, it was something that, it was actually my husband initially who sort of flagged it, and then the conversations just kind of kept coming, and I had some wonderful conversations with different Irish activists over the weekend, all of whom were so understanding and not judgmental, because there was a point where we were thinking, what's it going to look like if we go there, like for ourselves, like what will it look like with us going? And I think there would be no way, I think, any of us could justify being there, you know, even if we use the platform to kind of talk about the genocide that's happening in Palestine. It would just have been a way to, I think, make ourselves feel okay for being on those stages. And I think it's obviously, you know, we've galvanised now as an Irish contingent, which...
Because you've all decided to do this. It's like a mass boycott. You've all pulled out of this event. So essentially now we don't have any Irish bands taking part. What's been the response generally to your decision, which was a big decision for you, but from what you're saying, it was an obvious one and one you had to make?
Yeah, for our own, to be able to sleep at night, you know. I think it's great to see that people support our decision. I think we definitely reflect the views of the Irish people. 80% of people in this country recognise what they're seeing as genocide. And I think I'd like to, you know, make a point of, I can't sanction Israel, but the government can, you know. And I think we've made a stance that's an important one, you know.
But the government is going to be represented there because the media minister, Catherine Martin, will be there. Should she be there?
Look, I don't think what's done is done. I'd like to see her have a conversation with the governor of Texas, to be honest. I think that would be that'd be an interesting one. I think that I know from speaking to people that are over there now that she has given a degree of comfort to some of the acts that are there because, you know, from our position, we made that decision from the comfort of our own home. A lot of acts, you know, may not have seen certain things circulating and were faced with quite a pressurised situation. So I believe there's been good conversations and that she reflects our views, our collective views. So, yeah, that's all I have to say on that.
All right, OK. You know, I think, Faye, you're kind of cautious to kind of step in and say, you know, whether the minister should be there or should not. The choice has been made by the bands in this regard, Eoin. Do you think that Catherine Martin should have made a stand in solidarity with the Irish acts that are there and made a greater political stand in this regard?
Well, there has to come a point where somebody does something. Now, in fairness to the Irish government, on the international stage, we do say more and we have said more and we are stronger in our language in terms of what's happening, the genocide, than other governments. But that, for most of us, isn't enough. Though I grew up in the 80s and it was Dunstores workers who put pressure on government to change our position on apartheid South Africa. And I think, you know, it's when the artistic community do something similar at personal cost that puts a government minister in a difficult position, which she should be in. And I think if she was to walk away from that festival, she would be applauded. And I think she should. But I think collectively, all of us have to come to the conclusion that the only way this ends is when Israel are completely isolated politically, diplomatically, in the sporting world, in the artistic world, in the academic world. It's the only way they're ever, ever going to stop, because nothing else has worked. And it worked with South Africa, it'll work with Israel, because they're going to keep killing and keep killing and keep killing.
All right, so you're saying, Aon, that she shouldn't be going, she shouldn't be there.
I think these decisions aren't easy for government ministers. I appreciate that I can say this from here, and she has responsibilities that are wider to her office and a government responsibility. But in 30 years' time, Faye is going to be happy with what she did. I'm not sure if the minister is going to be happy with what she did.
All right. OK, Paul, to bring you in on this, it's an interesting one, because she was going to this festival to, you know, announce good news in terms of the work that she's doing and the minister is doing with, you know, artists in Ireland in terms of supplying, you know, a universal basic income. And now the spotlight is on her for the wrong reasons, you could say.
Yeah, and I suppose it is one of those things. A big signature part of Catherine Martin's work as arts minister has been that universal basic income programme, which was hugely popular, way oversubscribed, has worked really, really well. She was sitting on a panel today at South by Southwest with somebody from New York, actually a Palestinian-American, who, and they were comparing notes on the New York scheme against the Irish scheme. In her opening remarks, she outlined the Irish revulsion towards what is happening in Palestine. She said that there is a different... She said that she respects the decisions of all of the artists. She says that, you know, that kind of level of artistic expression, that freedom of speech, she would never criticise that. But she said that her brief out there is completely different, that it's different for politicians. Leo Varadkar has said the same thing, that you kind of, that by boycotting you take yourself out of things. He compared it to Russia, where Russia was banned from sporting events, it was banned from cultural events.
It's interesting though, because it is the citizens, I suppose it's people like, as Aon mentioned, the Dunn's workers, you know, the decision that you have made as bands not to go, that are leading the way, and then, you know, we'll see, will governments follow? Now, to date, the Irish government is saying it's doing all it can, but it's not following that. It's not going down the sanction route. It's not going down the boycott route to date.
No, and I think one of the things that really needs to be remembered here is just how big a deal South by Southwest is. I remember in my much younger days being in bands, that was the Holy Grail. It was, you know, John Mayer got discovered there, the Polyphonic Spree. Loads of great bands have been discovered or launched there. A lot of the Irish acts who were going out there, Faye, I don't know your particular situation, but a lot of the Irish acts who we hear on radio, aren't full-time. They're not, you know, at this, you know, they're not making a whole lot of money. Something like South by Southwest is a chance to go to that next level. To give it up based on your principles, you know, regardless of whether people agree with them or not, but to do that for 10 acts completely independently to all that make that decision is incredible. Hugely admirable. But like you said, it is that leading. And I think the government's in an awkward position, and I've written about this a couple of times, where the Irish public really wants more. They're frustrated, they feel helpless, they look at what they're seeing on their TV and they think it's abhorrent, that it cannot continue, and they want the government to go further. The government looks around in Europe and finds itself an outlier for being what we would consider fairly moderate. A lot of Irish people would look at that and say, look, they're going so far, but they're not going as far as I would like. And then they find themselves in Europe or in the States, where they're completely... And Catherine Martin, you know, in her opening remarks today, made an appeal to the American people to get on board, okay, to kind of join the Irish government.
All right. And we have yet to see how the Taoiseach gets on Friday when he meets with the US President Joe Biden. Faith, thank you for joining
us
tonight and, you know, for filling us in on that decision that you made about attending the festival. So we do appreciate it. Best of luck. My thanks to Faye, to Eoin and to Paul. Coming up after the break, another measles case confirmed in Ireland. Do stay with us. Welcome back. Another case of measles has been confirmed today, the fourth so far this year. An urgent public health alert remains in place for air passengers who arrived into Dublin from Abu Dhabi early last Saturday morning, and the HSE has confirmed a case of measles on the Etihad Airways flight and is appealing to those on board to come forward. Well, joining me to discuss this and the measles outbreak in this country are Kingston Mills Professor of Experimental Immunology in Trinity College Dublin. And I'm joined down the line by Dr. Scott Walken, Clinical Lead in Infection at the Irish College of GPs. You're both very welcome along to the programme. Kingston, to come to you first, how worried should we be about this?
I don't think there's any cause for panic on it. I think, you know, measles is a very serious disease, especially in people who haven't been vaccinated or haven't previously had measles. If you've had measles, you've got lifelong immunity. If you've had two doses of the vaccine, you've got lifelong immunity. But unfortunately, there's around 10% or up to 15% of the population who haven't been vaccinated or haven't had measles. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones that are really at risk. And it can be very serious in the unvaccinated.
Because vaccination rates have been falling, haven't they? And they're currently now below the uptake level that's needed to prevent community outbreaks. So if you have, despite everyone being vaccinated, if you have uptake levels below a certain level, does that put everybody at risk?
Yeah, I mean, the whole situation that you really aspire to is having 95% uptake of the vaccine. Because if we have 95% for measles, we'll prevent community transmission. Then you get what's called herd immunity. So you protect the whole community by 95%. But if it drops below 90, that can't be achieved. So if measles outbreak occurs, then it's possible for it to spread if only 90% or 85% of the population have been vaccinated.
And was this not a common disease even before we had the vaccine? I mean, how common was it?
Very common. Before we had the vaccine, 2.5 million people in the world died each year from measles. Wow. After the vaccine was introduced, it's dropped now to around 150,000 a year, mostly in developing countries. Deaths are very rare in countries like Ireland. Unfortunately, we had one case this year. So it is quite rare to have deaths from measles, but it can happen.
OK, so what do you think needs to be done, I suppose, from a public health perspective now that we've seen this number of cases? Is it just a case of stay vigilant, or are there other measures that need to be taken?
I think it's a cue for every parent to ensure that their child is vaccinated. And the first vaccine is given at 12 months, and then the booster is given at 4 to 5 years. And that two doses of the vaccine gives lifelong immunity. So if every parent ensures that their child is vaccinated, that is the best thing that can happen in terms of preventing future cases of measles. Mm.
All right, I want to bring Dr. Scott Walken in at this point, and we're just talking about the numbers who are getting vaccinated. And I'm immediately thinking, actually, of those children who may have got one vaccine, you know, around the age of one, but the booster comes when they start primary school. So they're not fully vaccinated. What should be done there? Can parents go and get an early second vaccination?
Well, the first MMR vaccine gives really good protection up until junior infants. So those children that are vaccinated on time at 12 months, they do not need to get their second vaccine early. What the benefit of the second vaccine, and actually Professor Mills has alluded to this, is that it provides some vaccine endurance, so the immunity will last for much longer. And it also slightly increases the proportion of people who are immune. But there's really good protection with the first dose up until the early years of primary school.
Why have we seen this drop off in vaccine uptake?
Well, it's a global phenomenon that vaccine uptake rates are falling. I think a lot of it is disinformation and misinformation and fake news. I think that's a significant factor. I think also there's an element of vaccine fatigue. You know, we have needed a lot of vaccines lately, and those vaccines have saved a lot of lives. But I think people have become a little bit tired of it. And I think another factor is that vaccines are so incredibly effective that they become a victim of their own success. So because the MMR and because, you know, all of our vaccines are so good at eliminating viruses and infections, or in other cases, reducing the severity of infections, you know, we forget how severe those illnesses can be without vaccination. So with measles, for example, you know, it's up until recently, we've just forgotten about it. We just don't see measles that much. But now that vaccine rates have fallen, we're seeing more of it, unfortunately.
So what should people look out for, the signs and symptoms? Because we saw this alert going out over people arriving in on a flight from abroad. But you know, what might people look out for now that we have seen a number of cases?
So when I'm assessing somebody, when I'm thinking about, well, could this person have measles, the first thing I do is I try and outrule the likelihood of measles by trying to work out, have they had age-appropriate vaccinations? So for adults and people older than junior infants, that means two MMR vaccines more than 4 weeks apart. And if they have had that, the likelihood of infection it's practically zero, really. You could say it is zero. With the other group, the other cohort that are protected against measles are people who were born in Ireland before 1978, because virtually all of those have had exposure previously to measles virus, and they're protected as well. So if somebody who I'm assessing is one of those, in one of those two age groups or one of those two categories, they're exceedingly unlikely to have measles. And then the types of symptoms, well, they're fairly non-specific. So temperature tends to be quite high, but lots of conditions do that. People do get red eyes, and then usually 2 to 4 days after the onset of the fever, they'll get a characteristic rash, and the diagnosis becomes a little bit easier then, and it can be confirmed by lab testing. So really, because the symptoms are fairly non-specific, I would always be looking to find out, well, has the person returned from an area where there's a high level of measles transmission? And there are a lot of those areas now. Or have they had contact with the confirmed case of measles?
All right.
So they're the sorts of things that help work it out.
OK, thank you, Dr. Scott Walken, for joining us. And my thanks to Kingston Mills as well. That is all we have time for. Our programme is available as a podcast on all major platforms. You can also now find us on Instagram, and we're on TikTok. But from all the Late team here and all our panellists, good night and do take care.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.